This is the People and Their Work podcast. I am Professor Doug Gardner in the Student Leadership and Success Studies Department at Utah Valley University. In this podcast, you will hear the first-person stories of people journeying through their education, work, and career decision-making. Mary Crafts is the founder of Culinary Crafts, a successful catering business. There is a lot to Mary Crafts. She shares her journey through sorrow, struggle, and sacrifice to how she became the woman she is today, focused on helping others heal.
A lot of people, whether they be students or whether they just be people in the community, my close friends, people I don't even know, just my social media network, look at Mary Crafts and think, wow. She must have been born with the right people, or she must have had that silver spoon, or she must have got lucky. They love to use that word. How'd you get so lucky? Like, let's start with that. Luck has nothing to do with your life. Never has, never will. Luck is something that is left to those people who don't have the tenacity to make things happen in their life. So for me, I tell people, I'm just like you. And if you didn't see how fabulous I was, then you see how awful I am. So one of those two things lives in you. If you see me as a dynamic, wonderful person, that's because that's what's in you. You're already living part of me. And as you develop and go through your life, you will see more and more of those kind of skills and talents come out. If you see me as an arrogant, self-absorbed, narcissistic kind of power woman that you never want to be like, well, chances are that those are the qualities they're currently manifesting in you. And neither one of those have anything to do with me. They only have to do with the eyes that you see the world through. So my beginnings started in rural Iowa in a town of 250 people. So pretty small town farm girl. And I was like voted the least likely to succeed in my graduating class. How about that? And I was the fat little girl who would never amount to anything, who was always messing up in school, not like her older brother and sister. Yes, I had great parents, but sometimes parents are involved in behaviors that they don't even recognize as being destructive for their children. They think they just want you to be perfect because, of course, they're being good parents. But in reality, they're putting expectations on us that feel like I'm never enough. That issue of being never enough pretty much plagued me my entire life until I reached 50. And when I realized that was why I was such a great caterer, was because I was afraid of messing up. I was afraid of a client being upset with me. I was afraid of not being paid. I was afraid of somebody being better than me, and that meant I was less than. So I was a great caterer, but for the wrong reasons. I was a great caterer out of fear, fear of not being enough. Rather than I was a great caterer because my life was based in love. And that's kind of the story of my life, how I went from living in fear to living in love and abundance. So following graduation from high school, I went to University of Northern Iowa, where I promptly flunked out of my first year of college with a 0.25 grade point average. And the only time I got an F in every other class except for choir, and I loved to go to choir, so I always went to choir. So I did get a little tiny bit of a grade point. When I decided to move west here, and I had recently joined the LDS Church and had wanted to go to BYU, they tentatively kind of took me in, but I had to come in on probation and jump through all sorts of hoops. But eventually then did graduate from BYU and began to kind of, well, what's next for me? And I think most students live their life, I know I did, in, well, I'll be happy when. And probably, if truth be told, most of the United States of America believes I'll be happy when. Because it's, well, when you graduate, or when you get married, or when you get have your children, or when you can buy your home, or when you can, you know, have be a two-car family, or when you've achieved, you know, 5,000 likes on social media. It's always then I will be able to be happy. And if that's how you're measuring your success and who you are, it will elude you your entire life. So as I went into marriage, obviously I was wanting to have the perfect marriage like everyone else. But because of my background of not being enough, I married a person who continued that scenario for me, who continued verifying my self-opinions of me. And I was in a very abusive relationship. I was in a relationship where there was physical abuse, mental abuse, emotional abuse, spiritual abuse, and social abuse, because he wanted to isolate me from all my friends and family. I stayed in that marriage for 28 years. But it was really by the time, my second year of marriage, that I realized, wow, this guy's never going to be able to hold down a job. He was bipolar and just, employment was just not in his bag of tricks. So he had a rage disorder, a paranoia disorder, bipolar. And then, of course, years later, when I did finally divorce him, discovered that he was gay. Now, this is a guy who has his own set of problems, and I tell you, there's a special place in heaven for him. But as a young college student, if I had looked down the road of what I was going to bring into my life, that wasn't it. As a young college student, I graduated from BYU and then thought, I'm going to find a guy that can take care of me the rest of my life, and I don't have to worry about any of this. Well, yes, it's true he was in the accounting program at BYU, but never went back to school once we were married. And my life took a different turn. So at that point in time, I had graduated in social work and was working as a social worker. And fortunately, I did have a job and supported our family until the birth of our first child. And I got pregnant on our honeymoon, so that was 9 months after I was married. And realized that I could not leave my child, that I needed to be home. And how do I do that? How do I support this family? So I tried teaching piano lessons. I sold Avon. This is back when you could sell Avon door to door and people would actually open their doors. Now I don't open my door for anybody until I look at my ring. Then I can say, oh yes, who is it? How can I help you? But back then you really did open and go door to door and sell things. I did a lot of things like that. Taught preschool, anything to keep my children with me. My second son came along 2 years later and we were on church welfare. I didn't know quite what my life was going to look like, but I never envisioned this. I never envisioned being in this relationship that was abusive. I never dreamed that I wouldn't have enough money. My parents always had enough money. Money was not an issue for us, and now to be on welfare. So I began to think about, well, what can I do? And then I thought, well, I've always liked to cook. And I've always loved to entertain. Just maybe I could cater. I wonder what that is. But I think I could do it. This was long before the internet, and you would go to the library and get your books, and I got books on catering. I thought, you know, I think I can do this. And so I began having little catering parties, kind of like Tupperware parties, where I would go to people's homes, they would invite their friends, I would show up, I would feed them food, I would talk to them all about the things that I could do. I could do their birthday parties, I could break their Sunday dinner, I could make rolls, I could do pies for a special occasion, and all the different things. And I began to give these women ideas in their head of how a little extra help in the kitchen would not be a bad idea. And from there, I took my little boys, put them in a red wagon, pulled them around the neighborhood. And let me tell you, if you're ever short on money, put two small children in a red wagon and pull them around the neighborhood, because anybody will buy anything for you if you have your children out there. And they were with me from the very beginning. So fast forward when I'm 65, those two boys knew as much about this company as I did. And so they were the natural people to take over. And now we're in the second generation of Culinary Crafts. That little tiny company grew to be the largest caterer in the state of Utah, 28 times best of state, international caterer of the year. I mean, just on and on, we have so many awards, we've had to put some of them away. And people often ask me, when you were in your little condo trying to bake all these breads and taking things to your neighbors to bake, did you ever dream that this is what would happen? And I always say the same thing, absolutely. Because if you don't first dream it, you can't make it happen. So one of the things I would love to leave with all of your listeners and your students is dream. Dream your passion. Dream what's inside. Let your mind go crazy with the possibilities. Don't limit yourself. Oh, well, I couldn't possibly do that because I didn't have this option. Listen, if you ever feel that it's not enough and that you're not going to be able to do this, just come stand toe-to-toe with me. I didn't start changing my life and becoming empowered and understanding what it meant to live with love until I was 50. 1 week away from my 66th birthday, I summited Kilimanjaro just to put my stake in the ground and say, I have done this. And then from there, I just saw more summits. Not the end of my summit, but the beginning of my summits. For me, my life began to change and turn around at age 50. And at age 50, everybody, of course, you have your 50th birthday party. Everyone wants to come and wish you well for your next few years until you get to the end. And this is before cell phones. And so when you took pictures, you took them to Kmart. And for those of you who don't know what Kmart is, it's like a Walmart, to get your film developed. And you didn't see what those photos looked like until about a week later you'd go and pick them up. So I was so excited to go and pick up those photos from Kmart and got out in the parking lot and began sorting through them. And about half of them were just gray and grainy and you couldn't use them. But a half of them, though, would be great. So I'm going through them and I came across a picture of me, just me. And as I looked at that picture, I thought, who is this woman? Is this how you thought it was going to end? Is this where you thought you'd be? A tremendously successful company, but a marriage that was so brutal, and your children that you're trying to keep together in a family. And I weighed 284 pounds. Life had taken its toll on me. I made a decision at that moment, after an hour and a half of crying, that I was going to live a different life. And what did that road look like? And I don't know all the answers yet, but at somewhere in the eternities, I hope to know way more than I do now. But if you live in a fear-based life at this end of the spectrum, and every one of your actions and your thoughts are motivated by your fear, and the base fear of all of us is that we are not enough, and we're constantly trying to prove that to others and mostly ourselves. And the goal on this side of the spectrum is love, to love yourself, to love others, to run your company with love, to see all the possibilities that are in front of you with love. So what's the passageway look like from there? How do you move through there? And as I sat there that day in my car, I knew the first step, and I think I knew it because I took time to ponder it. Sometimes we don't take time to ponder. We expect to be spoon-fed with what are the answers and just tell me what to do and I'll do it. But in my life since age 50, I've realized that I came to this planet with every single answer inside of me. I just have to listen. Now, sometimes that happens through prayer, but usually prayer is more like ask, 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 need, need, need. Take care of this person. I don't know, you know. But the other side of that is when we take time to listen. And for me, that's called meditation. When I quiet my mind and I'm listening for what I'm to do and where I'm to go and what I'm to learn and the pathways just open up, like miraculously, for me to step in and learn those things. But the very first step is the most critical one. I invite all of you to listen to this and think about this and the power that this can have for you. The very first step is vulnerability. I had to stop hiding who I was. These fears that were inside of me, I had to stop hiding my marriage and how miserable I was. I had been protective of my family and of Ron and not having anybody know. And the moment I was willing to say, I'm struggling, I have some problems, this is what I'm dealing with, the very things that I thought were going to turn people away were the very things that brought them to me. And they'd be like, I struggle with that. I didn't know somebody else did. And suddenly you have these massive amounts of people being your tribe, working through things with you. And as I would learn one lesson in front of somebody, they would want to know what that was. When someone else would learn another lesson in front of me, I would listen to them. And you would just build this tribe of people who were headed the same direction, who their goals in life were not simply, how big is my house and am I going to have a boat? But their goal in life was to be the very best version of themselves. And once you're on that pathway, you can lift others to be the very best version of themselves. I didn't know that that was the direction life was going to take me. We have this little bit of problem here in Utah that women sometimes don't choose to graduate because they get married. And then they think, well, of course, now my husband's going to take care of me. Well, I had already graduated, but I certainly thought my husband was going to take care of me. But that was not what life dealt me. And I don't want to think of it in terms of that's what life dealt me, but rather, but that's not what I drew into my life. And the reason I say that is because I want everyone to pack their bags and leave Victimville. I want everyone to be accountable for what's happening in their life. After I gave a talk one time, I had a woman come up to me crying, and she said, Mary, so what you want me to believe is that I'm responsible for my husband beating me? I said, oh, no, my love, come here. And as I held her in my arms, I said, you are never responsible for another person. You are only responsible for you. So what you're feeling, what you're going to do with those feelings, what you're going to act so that you're not a victim. The great news about being accountable for everything that's in your life is that you can change it. You can't change anything as long as you're a victim. The greatest example of this, there are a lot of people in history, but I think of Viktor Frankl. In Germany, he had every single thing taken from him, his home, his income, his house, his jewelry, his everything. They were put in those concentration camps. His children, once they arrived, he never saw them again. He saw his wife for just a few days, and then he never saw her again. He was experimented on. He was burned. He was starved. They made him just be naked in his cells and barracks, even the winter, to go out to get food, no clothes. He had every reason in the world to give up and to play victim. Poor me. Why did this happen to me? How did I end up here? Has God turned his back on me? But he did not. Instead, he realized the one thing that could not be taken from him was his mind and his ability to choose. They could not take from his ability to choose, what am I learning from this? Who am I going to be when I finish walking through this trial? And let me tell you, he ended up to being a truly great, phenomenal man. That's all I ask, is that I learn every step, that I never get caught in being a victim. People say, so how did you lose 284 pounds, half of you? He said, like, if you can imagine the other person sitting here. I said, well, I began to look at my fears and address my fears, each and every one of them. So I would look at the behavior, and the behavior that was easiest for me to look at the time, the first one that was easy, was overeating and not taking care of myself. And so when I'd be thinking about, oh, I need to stop and get a candy bar, I'd stop and go, okay. Just before that, what were you thinking about just before that action came into your mind? I was thinking about going and meeting with a client, and I was afraid she would reject me and that she wouldn't choose me to cater her event and that I wasn't enough. I began to look at every single situation in my life that way. And step by step, I wrote them all down. And when this happened, what was I feeling here? What was the fear? And as you begin to identify those things in your life, the next time it comes up, you're like, oh, I know you. Your fear, and this is what I was going to do to handle my fear as opposed to embrace my fear and overcome my fears. So the last 10 or so years of my catering career, my company vastly changed. We were doing the exact same things, but for different reasons. The energy in the company, the people loving to be there. I'm going to say something to you I've never admitted to anybody, but in the early parts of my career, I felt in order to get people to work for me, I had to manipulate them because I was afraid they would leave me. So I would do these things. Now you're going to think these things are great, but they were for the wrong reasons. When they'd walk in the door, I'd greet them with their names and I'd pat them on the back and I'd say, good job. And I'd drop an extra $100 in somebody's pocket because they did such a wonderful event last night. And thank you so much, Kitchen, for working so hard. I'm going to bring in lunch for you all today. Now, all those things are great things, but they were doing inside of me what I knew to be manipulation. And I needed to manipulate because I was afraid they would leave. Because I was afraid I wasn't enough. So as I walked through this process, I still began to do the same behaviors, but my energy was so transformed, people could sense it. And they took that energy out to the events, out to clients, out to guests, out to their families. And it kind of was this gradual different shifting in energy. An energy shift that was so phenomenal that even after I retired, it continued to change my life. Now, I retired at age 65, and now that I'd all lost all this weight and I'd committed to go to the gym every day and I'd be, you know, the strongest woman at the gym, that was my, you know, goal. Not as I needed to be the strongest woman, but I needed a goal to set forth for me to be working at all the time. And here I am, 69, and I still think I'm the strongest woman at the gym. But the reason became not to be the strongest woman, but to be my very best self. And what did that look like? When I'm at the gym, is this my very best? Am I giving my very best? Nope, two more reps. Got it, okay. And when I climbed Kilimanjaro, for me, it was like putting a stake in the ground to say I've done this. But I learned a lot of lessons on Kili. And one was, it was the hardest thing I've ever done, both emotionally and physically. I went alone, and even though I had a climbing team, they were all together. They'd climb together a lot, and then there was me. And that very first night, when we were around the campfire and we're talking about all the different mountains we've climbed and about how much we trained and those kind of things, I was the last to go, and I hope to shout, I knew I was in trouble. I didn't train that much. I mean, this one woman talked about, you know, walking 150 miles. And I'm like, oh, I've totally walked more than 150 miles. And then she went, a week. A week! What the heck is that? And, you know, they talked about doing the stair climber, you know, to build up their legs and those things. And I thought, well, I did the stair climber. And then she said, but sometimes I vary between 20 pounds of rocks in my backpack and 40 pounds. And I'm like, rocks in the backpack? What is she talking about? And we went around and talked about, there were two of them that had summited Everest. All of them had been to Denali. And Rainier. And so it came around to me. They said, well, tell us what you've summited, Mary. Well, I went to Machu Picchu, and I did that because that's, you know, up at 14,000, and then so it really trains your lungs. And they said, oh, yeah, that's a pretty good walk up the mountain. I went, yep, sure is. And they said, hey, what else? And so I said, well, I did this other mountain, but you probably have not heard about it. I said, because it's a very obscure mountain. And they said, well, I said, it's a big, hard climb. I mean, it is, like, brutal. It's straight up. It's a vertical climb. It's just, like, right up. And they said, well, what's the name of it? And I said, Timpanogos. And they're like, no, I haven't heard of that. I said, well, just check it out. You'll love it, you know. I mean, I knew I was out of my league. So all the fears that I had felt that I thought I had overcome, fear of not being enough, fear of not having the right clothes. I realized I didn't have the right winter jacket to go up to the top. And he said that he's going through my stuff, the guy, and he was like, that's not enough. Well, what am I going to do? Have Ari drop ship something? I mean, you know, you're just like, okay, well, I guess I'll just go anyway. And fear of, you know, being rejected by people. Everything came to play. And you know how many times I told that mountain, you know, in Utah, they love me. In Utah, they think I'm really something. I've really accomplished a lot, just so you know. And the mountain would say back to me the same thing every day. I don't care. I only care what you bring today. And that lesson has been with me. It's why I launched a new career. It only matters what I bring today. Doesn't matter what I accomplished in the past. Doesn't matter that I graduated from college. Doesn't matter that I got my three kids to graduate. None of that mattered. It only mattered what I brought that day on the mountain. And that's the lesson I brought home with me. Each day of my life matters. And when I wake up when I go to bed at night, I think through my day. And I feel a sense of gratitude that I was able to do those things. And when I wake up in the morning, I think about my day ahead. And once again, filled with so much gratitude that I have the opportunity to live one more day, to do those things. I have a vision for my life. And I think every person, in order to be successful, and in order to accomplish the things that are in front of them, really need to have a vision. And everyone defines vision differently. I define it as, you know, the end goal, what you see, where you want to be, where you're going. But your mission is what you're doing every single day. It's also how I climbed Kilimanjaro. My vision was to get to the summit, but 90% of the time, you couldn't see the summit. You had to think about what was happening 100 yards ahead of you. And if you can get to that point, then you could stop, take a breath, take a drink of water, and go on again. But then the other great lesson was that wasn't enough either. You had to watch your feet, where you were putting them every single step, or you'd step off the trail and down a 1,000-foot drop. When I was losing weight, same thing. I had a goal. Way at the top, the summit, that was my vision. And my mission was just to get to lose 20 pounds. Just to lose 20 pounds. And I did that every time. But the way to do it was to watch what my feet were doing every day on a daily basis. Sometimes I'd look down and I'd be like, feet, where are you going? That's the wrong way. Turn back this way. Okay, I don't care that you're tired. Are you going to get your shoes on? Are you going to go to the gym? Darn straight I am. And then you'd get your feet on and you'd go and be done. You have to be watching what you're doing every single day. You know, if I were a student at UVU, you may have already picked a degree. You may think you know where you're going. You may be completely lost. I was all those spectrum ends. But this is kind of, for me, how I determined what I was going to do for a career other than social work, and how I determined what I was going to do for a career once I retired from that career. For my next career. You see, I plan on living to be 105. So that gave me, even from this point, I have 35 more years left. What, just to sit around and eat bonbons and play golf and watch TV? Oh, that just sounds awful. So you have to have a vision for your life. And this is how I think that's determined. And it's by finding your passion. Now, that is such a catchphrase, and you hear it so many times. You can go on YouTube and you can enter in, podcasts on finding your passion. Okay, and you'll come up with, you know, 1,000 of them, and you can begin to listen to them. So this is the short version, so you don't have to watch all those. I think passion is that piece of us that maybe we don't understand at the moment. Because people say, well, tell me what you're passionate about. I think about when I was in college, would I really have said I was passionate about, you know, going out and helping people and, you know, being a parole officer and making sure somebody was staying by the rules? I mean, probably not. It didn't seem to really be a passion of mine to work as a social worker, but the idea of helping people was always a piece of that. And why? Because what I truly wanted to do was help myself. And that was one of my passions, to help myself. This is what I think is a good idea, to find out what your passion is. You ever start talking and then all of a sudden in the conversation, people start talking in a different direction? And like, well, wait, I was talking. Okay, no one's interested, no one cares. Or you're talking along and then people just get up and leave the room. Okay. Whatever you were talking about, trust me, it's not your passion. Because when you speak passion, no one leaves. And people are turning to you. They want to hear what you say. You have an energy about you that you don't have any other time. So when I started talking about food and I started thinking about, you know, what I liked about food and how people felt about food. And when you gather for celebrations and seeing that whole aura of hospitality. And when I had somebody in my office and I was talking to them about food, when I was talking about them grilling that steak perfectly, flipping it over, and oh, and then when you cut into it, the juices, and I coat it with a gorgonzola butter that just melts through that steak. I'm telling you, people, I had them drooling. And when I, because I talked with passion, they just wanted me to tell me more. Tell me about the butter. Okay, I'll tell you about the butter. You know what I mean? And I was so in love with food and the beautiful sense of being that it could give to a celebration, that I could sell it. I could sell it like nobody's business. People wanted to hear me talk about it. It's why I had a 13-year cooking show on PBS, because people loved how I talked about food, and they wanted to do it. And I would end every show with, and honey, if I can do this, you can do it. And I truly believe that if you have a passion for something, you can do it, no matter what you think are the limitations. So I want you to start watching what you talk about and when people are listening to you and when you don't. And when people are listening to you, chances are you're talking about something that you're passionate about. Maybe you're talking about your car. Maybe you're talking about food. Heaven forbid, I don't know, understand this, but maybe you're talking about STEM. Or something to do with math. Or I remember, this is the very first accountant I ever hired. And he was from South Africa. He was retired, and they moved here to Utah. And he decided he didn't like retirement. So he came into the office, and he said, I heard from somebody in my neighborhood that you were maybe thinking about hiring an accountant. And I said, I'm thinking about it, but I don't know. I probably can't afford you. And he said, trust me, you can. And I said, really? He goes, I don't care how much you pay me. I just want to work here. I want to work doing things accountants do. And I said, what? You like that? And he said, do you know the feeling when you balance in one line and adds up to another line and you see it just all coming out like equal? And I'm like, no, I don't understand any of that kind of passion. But the more he talked, he had passion about numbers, passion about accounting. I hired him on the spot. And Alton was with us for 18 years. He retired when he was 80 from working at culinary. And I miss him still. But come be aware of what gives you excitement. Maybe you're flipping through all of social media, heaven forbid, and where do you stop? Do you stop on things that you probably have passion about? And I've had people say to me, I don't have any of that, Mary. You were different. I don't have passion about anything. In fact, I don't really care about much. I couldn't find my passion if it was in my right pocket. Ah. Would you like to find it? Yeah. Maybe you think you have some stuff to work through on your own before you can find it? Yeah, probably. Ah, so your passion right now is to understand you and to find that whole being that you know you are and discover the light within. That's your passion. Yeah, that's what I'd like to do. And when you find that piece, the next piece of passion opens up, and the next piece. I never knew that I was going to end up in this world of the nonprofit world, charity, and philanthropy. I didn't know I was going to do a podcast now with over 275 episodes. I didn't know I was going to be speaking about the power of overcoming fear. I didn't know that I was going to be asked to travel here. I didn't know I was going to write a book about it. I didn't know any of those things. But all that passion began to unfold as I began to heal myself more and more. So if you're feeling passionless, chances are the best place to start is right here with you. Because you know what you need. And when you do, watch out, world! You're going to be amazing! Because here's the great news is we were all born enough. We were all born with every bit of knowledge and information we need in this life. But our parents, bless their hearts, laid down these tapes in our brainstem where the fight and flight lives. And the thing about that part of the brain is it doesn't know the difference between truth and a lie. So no matter what it heard growing up, oh my gosh, what's wrong with you? How could you do that? Your sister doesn't do that. Blah, blah, blah. Do that over again. It's not right. No matter what you heard, it took in as truth. That wasn't good enough. I'm not good enough. And you lay those down. The cerebral cortex part of your brain doesn't usually begin to develop till after 8. Sometimes you're in your late 20s before it completes up there. And so you are now equipped with the best part of your brain that you didn't have before. So you get to go back and re-examine all those lies that you've been living and believing and saying, wait a minute, that's not true. I know that's not true. And I get to replace that tape inside of me. For 10 years, I put a post-it note on my bathroom mirror that I looked at every single day. And it literally changed my life. And the post-it note was, what would you do today if you were no longer afraid? Every morning I would look at that post-it note and ask myself, if I wasn't afraid today, what would I do? Well, usually I'd drive to that Chamber of Commerce meeting and I'd drive around the block and pretend I can't find a parking place and then go home. If I wasn't afraid today, I'd park at the first place I found. I would walk inside, and rather than being worried about that no one's talking to me, or I'm sorry, I have a dress on and they have pants on, or that I don't have any friends in the room, I would walk right up to someone and I would say, hi, I'm Mary Crafts. I see you have a name tag. Where do I get those? And they would point right over there. And I'd go, oh, that's great. And I'd go over and get my name tag. And later on, I'd see that person, you know, in the food line. And I'd stop and I'd go, thanks so much for pointing it out. This is my first time here. And I'm so excited to be here. So what's the agenda? How's this usually run? Oh, well, there's usually kind of this network time. And then we have a speaker. And they say, well, why don't you come over and sit by me? Oh, I'd love to. Thank you so much. Now, that person is geared for success because I let go of my fears. And I just did it for one day. One day, and the next thing you know, you have a year, and the next thing you know, you have 10, and it's now been 19 years since I changed my life. This new career of mine has been the most exciting thing I've ever done. It's what I was put on this planet for. I thought my career here was going to be from this point on about teaching people to let go of their fears and to become this magnificent being that they really know they are. But then about a year ago, I had a new vision. And it's a very private and personal vision that was given to me in meditation. But the crux of it is, I came to understand what the dream of humankind is. and it is to achieve oneness. What else dream would we have? And so for the rest of my life, I'm going to devote every piece of me to becoming one with those who are in pain, with those who are in love, with those who are at the top of the mountain and those who are at the bottom. I'm done seeing us as separate, us and them. I'm done with that. I want to hang with people who want to create oneness. I'm not going to hang anymore with those people who think us and them. When the war in Ukraine broke out, I just had this vision. And I saw those people. And I was them. And they are me. A week later, I just showed up on the border of Romania. And I said, put me to work. How can I help? I would go across the border into Ukraine and get mothers and children and bring them across, help them find their shelter and care and get them hooked with an organization. And I would just spent 2 weeks just getting people across. I went into Moldova, and the people in Moldova were so overwhelmed with all the refugees. They didn't know what to do. And I said, well, you need to bring in, like, for example, World Food. And that's an international organization, but they're not going to come and help you unless you have a plan of what you're going to do with their money. I don't know how to do that. I'm so busy trying to feed the people that are coming in my back door. How can I possibly put together a plan? Well, let's do it together. And the only reason I went was because I saw them as me and me as them. And that's what I'm spending the rest of my life doing. The students that are listening to this, just know, you are me, and I am you. I live this life to lift you and to lift me. And that's my hope for all of you.
I am Doug Gardner, and this has been the People and Their Work podcast. Music by Christopher Weiss. Images are from the UVU Roots of Knowledge stained glass exhibit by Holdman Studios.